Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition for cats and dogs. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. Feel free to email me at radiopetlady@gmail.com if you have any questions or topics you'd like Dr. Sean to cover. This show is a production of 8paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. I am here with the wonderful Dr. Sean. We're able to actually catch him between very long airplane flights, China, the Netherlands, good golly. And that's from California, which maybe is not so terrible for China, but the Netherlands, I don't know, maybe you go round and round the mulberry bush to get there. Dr. Sean, you have been in such demand around the world, always have been online or on telephone, but now they actually got your living, breathing body there to talk at these international, I guess, pet food forums, right?
Yeah, I had a couple of opportunities to speak. I did a national talk at the AVMA in Denver, and then I followed that up with a trip to Shanghai for the pet food industry in China. But it also served a variety of Asian countries. So folks from, you know, Thailand and Korea were there, right, and some other places. And then I also went to the Netherlands to speak to the European nutritionists on some topics. And so, you know, you mentioned about being online and all those resources. I feel like I was going back in time where we had to remove our body's mass to a physical location to talk to folks before there was a, you know, all these newfangled technologies like, you know, the internet. But it is good to go in person. I think you get a different perspective being there. It was I've been to Europe, obviously, before. I've even been to the Netherlands before, but I had never been to Shanghai. I've been to Hong Kong and Kowloon and some other Asian countries before, but I'd never been there. And, you know, the thing that was shocking to me is it was the number of people in Shanghai is that, you know, there's 22 or 23 million people in a city. And at first I said, that's really impossible. But then you drive along, you know, from the airport to the city center, and it's about a 45-minute drive. And along the way, you just see cluster after cluster of 30-story buildings that are, you know, condominiums and housing for folks. And then, you know, obviously industrial buildings too, but it's just, it is truly what a mega city looks like. And unfortunately, they're struggling, I think, with the demands on city systems with pollution and, you know, all the issues that come with water quality and yes, other issues. But it was really interesting. And, you know, I've been to a lot of different conventions and trade shows, but they had this pet food forum in conjunction with pet retailers, mostly from China. So folks that have pet stores, online stores, and this was an opportunity for different vendors to show their wares to these folks. And it was open to the general public as well. And it was massive. I've been to, you know, similar places, Super Zoo, for example, right, that takes place in Las Vegas,
which is gigantic. You could walk for half an hour and not go end to end.
Yeah, and that's it was that or greater. And, you know, the level of sophistication was, you know, I guess everyone has their inherent bias as to what they initially expect, but the quality of the build, if you will, of their yes, trade show booths was extremely high. I mean, these were, you know, two-story structures at times.
Wow.
Very, very high end. You know, one section was mostly dedicated to pet food on one of the convention halls. And then they had an adjoining convention hall that was mostly durable goods, as we would may refer to it, you know, collars and
right,
leashes
and toys.
Beds and toys, exactly. And, you know, it was just really, really impressive. And in the major host for the whole show, when I was speaking to the gentleman that's in charge, he was actually from France. And he said that they plan for next year to move into a third hall, which
wow,
already they're in two massive halls. I mean, it's one of the biggest convention centers I've ever seen in my life, if not the biggest. So it's really what was, I think, the initial impression to me was, you know, how much of a demand there is, how really sophisticated it is and comparable to what you might experience in what we quote unquote call a developed country.
Right.
And I think what was, you know, I think a little bit heartwarming is a reminder that as a species, as humans, we really love our pets. and that crosses ages, that crosses, you know, cultural divides. And part of that was, you know, what the biggest draw at any time for anything was any dog that was walking down the aisle with their, you know, pet owner. And it was surprising to me, though, that they had no medium sized dog that I see. It was either these massive, massive dogs or really small, perfectly and impeccably groomed, like miniature poodles.
I'll be darned. Well, you know, what's interesting to me on Tales from China, with my usual co-host, Mary Peng, who started the International Center for Veterinary Services, which is a, I think, 7,000 or 17,000 square foot facility. I'm never good on numbers, but it's the only one that the Chinese authorities have permitted to have outside veterinarians and outside of China funding. And they sell many things from food to hard goods, and they have a lot of vets. But pet ownership is so new in China that I'm amazed that already there's this marketplace around it, because that marketplace, I doubt, is aimed outside of China. Because if those companies wanted to purvey their stuff outside of China, surely they would go to the convention center in Lyon, France, or Super Zoo. So this must be for internal stores, internal consumers.
Yeah, it was definitely domestic. And, you know, the adjoining this was a meeting for, which is what I was speaking, which was for pet food manufacturers and associated, you know, suppliers to those manufacturers. So there were folks that, you know, had their extruder or their dryer equipment or their supplier. A lot of bag suppliers, a lot of packaging suppliers were there in a separate, you know, corner, if you will, of the convention hall. But yeah, the rest of the folks, they looked like they were domestic, had come in from other parts of China to, you know, find out what they were going to be carrying in their store. And the sophistication and the demand, you know, based on at least what I saw, was very, very high. And you know, I think what we have to remember is that when you have billions with a B of people, even a small percentage of them with an interest represents millions and millions and millions of people and becomes a very sophisticated and advanced market. And there is certainly wealth. You know, I think I saw that more in Shanghai than maybe I would have seen in provinces. But, you know, it was not uncommon for me to see very high end luxury cars driving around as I went around the city.
Right.
And there were, in just going into the quote common areas, as you do, I had about a day and a half to do, you know, just sightseeing.
Right.
And I walked about, and there were very few Caucasians, if you will. So,
right.
You know, I don't know where they came from, but just the dress of people and the people walking around, I could have been in any, you know, major metropolitan city in the world. And there was no evidence of them, you know, having any issues with paying for things. There were, you know, there was a lot of wealth, and that may be an aspect of, you know, Shanghai different than provinces, but it's still, remember, there's 20 some odd million people in Shanghai, and that alone becomes like a large country in a lot of other places.
That's true. And of course, Shanghai was the part of China. It's not just different than the provinces. It's different than Canton or Beijing, because Shanghai was where the foreigners always had set up shop. I mean, I knew someone in the film industry who grew up there. His parents were, I don't know if they were in commerce or in diplomacy, but Shanghai has always been an incredibly international city well before the modern, what we think of as sort of this more
right.
modern age. So that's just a foundation that's built. But I love your comment that we are all one species, we humans, and our desire for the human-animal bond and our desire to live with another species as a pet, it seems to be hardwired. It's part of being human. And maybe some of us would say part of the best part of being human. So it's fantastic to discover, because in talking to Mary Peng, there's a sense of this nascent pet-owning population where it was illegal to own a dog before 1993. And interesting, your comment, I'd like to go to that, of seeing these very large dogs, because her explanation has been on previous shows that originally the only dogs allowed in cities or any part of China, but let's just say cities, were large guard dogs used to guard military facilities or very costly or valuable other kinds of facilities. And they were extremely ferocious. They were bred and trained to be. so that once people were allowed to own animals, large dogs were only perceived as a scary, like, attack machine. And to this day, there's quite a bit of fear of them and resistance even to them being allowed in society. So, like, what kind of, did you see dogs that looked like a Leonberger or a St. Bernard or some Chinese version of a gigantic dog?
I saw some Huskies, but maybe some Leonbergers. I'm trying to remember. I didn't see any German Shepherds physically, but I saw packaging that highlighted them.
Interesting.
So what we would consider, I mean, some large and even giant breeds, and not what I would expect to see normally, you know, and especially because it's a relatively humid climate. Some of these were with very full coats,
yes,
you know, and dogs that probably are not the most suited to a warmer environment because it's coastal and it gets warm. And I think we forget that. But, you know, the whole time I was there, I think it was in the upper 80s and 90s. And so, you know, a quite a warm place, especially without air conditioning, if that's, you know, what you have. So it was intriguing to me to see that because, you know, and obviously I only have a very small window
of course,
of into this. But to your point about that, I do think there was a generational aspect to it because a lot of the folks that were hovering around, if you will, you know, the dogs especially, were the younger generation.
Right.
And part of what drove me to that is that I was surprised that even the folks that did not have any pets with them were very actively social media. I don't know what that looks like in China,
it's
given the censorship.
It's different than ours, right.
Right. But still, they were very actively taking what I would call selfies with
right.
the dogs that were not their own, and so there, and that's a much more of a young person's activity, I think, in a general sense. And so I do think that maybe the bias of, you know, that a large breed dog is something to be feared is probably maybe something that has been lost.
You're right. Or,
and maybe not as present in folks that don't remember when they couldn't have dogs, and these, and they were equally intrigued or going up to the large breeds to say hello to them as I saw people going up to these extremely small, you know, miniature poodles. There was a few Yorkies, you know, much, much smaller and less intimidating breeds.
Well, it's really, although it was a short window and a small window, it was a very intense one because you're in a setting full of professionals. And while the elegance or the sophistication of their booths, in a sense, doesn't totally surprise me because I think of the Chinese as being the quickest, the most agile, the most excellent at creating things. I mean, that's why so many products are made in China, particularly in the pet industry. They can change something and fix it and change the color and add the clip somewhere else. At least so I've heard from manufacturers of small hard goods. So their ability to build an incredible set, they're like little movie sets, right? Some booths.
Right. It was basically movie sets. And I don't know if that's an extension of their labor cap, you know.
Right.
And the ability to have a lot of people because there's a lot of people there. But yeah, it's their ability to make things is just remarkable.
Yes. And I think that's something that we sort of forget when we get freaked out about certain food products that have come from China that have turned out to have toxicity. And then there's this kind of danger bell that goes, in a funny sort of way, goes off with us as American pet consumers, the way maybe a large dog does to the parents or the grandparent generation in China who have a fixed idea that a large dog is a biter and it's dangerous. And apparently those older generations used to tell little children, Mary said, when growing up, stay away from the dogs. Dogs bite. Dogs are dirty. Dogs are dangerous. But of course, the new generation is discovering something different. So I think what you saw was this enormously fast evolution, which he also says is very much a part of China, that if a dog is 7 years for every one of ours, every moment of their evolution and expansion, if you, or growth, is like seven times faster than here. It's just like blooming, you know, it just goes fast.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, one of the most remarkable interactions I had, because I went up to the different suppliers, you know, from the pet food side of things, because I'm just intrigued to
of
kind
course.
Of understand what
I would
what
love it.
And what was most amazing is I went up to this one booth. They had a small extruder, probably that could make, 400 pounds an hour, which would be about a tenth the size of a typical production size. So more of like a pilot plant extruder.
Okay.
But when I say that, you go, oh, well, that must be small. It's still something that, you know, would be several tons and, you know, be this, you know, probably 20 feet long.
Right.
But I said, oh, you know, you kind of go and go, what does this cost? You know, it's an easy question to ask the salesman who's standing there.
And you know what things should cost because Balance It has this fantastic line of veterinary products now that speak to medical issues of dogs. So you have created that, and you've created it from the ground up, and so you know what everything would cost here, right?
Right, right. And I've you know, been in industrial production before, and I've worked with folks, and I've gotten quotes from the U.S. side of things. And so he gave it to me in the local currency, and it's, you know, I knew what things were supposed to convert, and I thought that there was a miscommunication. So we wrote it down and confirmed, and then I said, oh, for the extruder, it seems extremely reasonable. And then he pulled out a brochure, and it had not just the extruder, but also something that would basically homogenize the mix before it goes into the extruder, a preconditioner that kind of does some other work before
mixing.
It goes in the extruder, and mixing and some heating sometimes, right. Adding some water. And then the extruder itself, and then they also had a dryer, and then a picture of an enrober, which is the coating on the outside of
kibble,
that whole line. And then he goes, no, that's the price for this entire line. And then I went back and I thought, well, this, and I confirmed, and he called someone else over that's better in English, and they said, yes, this is the price. And I'm going to tell you why. And then they followed up and emailed me.
My
and
God.
Said, yes, this is the price, you know, kind of wanting
wow.
to sell.
Wow. Yes.
And here, guess what the price of the entire line
is? I can't wait.
Was.
Well, I first have to know what it would cost in the U.S., just want any part of it. What your guess would be.
Production size equipment would be more, but to do a full, even pilot line with all those components, you're probably looking at about $1 million.
Okay, that sounds like a number that makes sense to me when we're talking these huge pieces of machinery.
Yeah, pieces of equipment, yeah. So their cost, $30,000.
Oh, my God.
And then on top of that, they said, if you pay for our engineers to come to do the installation and the training and stuff, guess how much their per diem cost was?
I'm ready.
$50 a day.
Oh my God.
And so what that told me is that the cost of entry, because granted there are a lot of people that $30,000 might as well be $1 million.
But not an industry.
But not in industry. The Chinese are not that far off from us. The cost of entering into the market, and granted you'd want something with a bigger, a higher scale, but the cost of just making some food of equipment is much, much lower than it would be here in the States and or in a lot of other countries. And that was really eye-opening to me because I looked at all these pet food manufacturers, and you could see that they were seeing a huge opportunity and an opportunity that for who knows however many more decades of substantial year-over-year growth as people adopt pets.
Yes.
And so, you know, U.S. companies are definitely present and trying to make a higher presence there with their products. But already there's an interest in what I would consider the highest and most premium foods, you know, what I spent a good portion of my time talking about and where people had questions about were natural, ultra premium grain-free foods. That was what the pet food industry wanted, mirroring what we would say is the most, you know, expensive and highest end foods that we have in here in the U.S.
And I'd like to say, Sean, that it took us in the U.S. if the pet food industry started in, was it the 40s or the 50s, the idea of kibbling food in a bag, more or less the 50s, the 60s?
Yeah, extrusion technology, 50s and 60s.
Okay,
yep.
So look at that, whatever it is, 50 or 55 years it took us, or maybe it took us only 45 years to get to the point where the quality of the kibble, the ingredients of the kibble, not only did people know to think about it or ask for it, but companies then evolved to create these foods. Evo being one that you were one of the co-creators of, was one of the highest end, most high protein, most excellent ingredients kibbles. When it came out, it was unique in its class, let's say. And here are the Chinese. They've had a decade of dog ownership, one decade, during which the beginning was like trickles of dogs. And even in this amount of time, they've already zoomed to the head of the class and understood what we should do is not do the cheapest version, but go for the very best. So it seems like the money could potentially, the cost of the product, could actually go into the ingredients if people were being really ethical and correct about it, not in the manufacturing equipment.
I think it's really a testament to your comment earlier about how quickly things are evolving and how quickly, you know, the market is developing and why you see even multinational corporations saying, hey, you know, we're going to go into South America or we're going to go into Asia.
Yes.
Because of the opportunities. And that then goes to countering it to my experience in Europe and going to the Netherlands. And a good portion of the conversation was all about how are we going to deal with you know, the rest of the world going to the level that we're currently at? How are we going to do that in a sustainable way with the limited resources we have in the world? How are we going to deal with, as Europeans, that our population is shrinking, not growing, and markets aren't, you know, going to be growing robustly anymore because it's matured? And it's really was interesting.
Isn't that fascinating?
It was really interesting within, you know, a 3 or 4 week period to see this very different viewpoint, both related to the pet food industry and pets and stuff, both about folks that really obviously care about pets, which is wonderful, and we share that common bond. But really looking at it from a very different perspective of, you know, if we have limited resources, and what does that look like to the price of commodities? What does that look like on the pressure of the available arable or land we can produce food on?
Right.
What does that look like, you know, as people demand organic? You know, organic yields, organic food yields are nothing compared to what you get from, quote, conventional agriculture. And so, you know, when I was sitting there talking to some folks that were also speaking and present from the U.S. At the Pet Food Forum China, a couple of them are from the Kansas area. And so they either currently or still do farm as part of the side. You know, they work for pet food companies, but they still have their family farms. And, you know, their initial comment about people with, you know, wanting to do organic is, go, I don't know how that's going to work.
Yes.
You know,
it's impractical in a sense.
It really is in some sense, because the yields that we've been able to attain that way are just not as great. And if you have a population in the world overall that's going to be increasing another 50% before maybe we plateau, how do you find and feed? It's not like there's a lot of land anymore that we're not farming or using for something.
That's right. And if you're going to use protein, you have to do a lot more farming to create the feed for those live animals.
Right.
We have
several talks on feed conversion, actually a specific talk on feed conversion. And one of the researchers, it was one of the main keynotes, was talking about all of their work to looking at insects, which we've touched upon before.
Yes, we had the
protein
bug show.
Source. And he was from the human side of things, and talking about on the human side how they've introduced and in the Netherlands, they have tried to have an outreach and change perception about protein sources from insects. And they showed that in over a decade period, they'd actually been able to, with the help of the Queen and other, you know, celebrity chefs and things, and outreach, change people's mindset. Yeah, sure, I don't mind having some protein coming from insects. And that is now a developing market and industry where they're integrating, you know, these different insect meals as a rich protein source into baked goods and foodstuffs, and they say that, you know, this is one of the ways that we might be able to address the very question of how do we deal with our advancing population in a sustainable way that is demanding more protein in a higher nutritional plane than historically they've been able to get in a lot of parts of the world.
And of course, which is fascinating, and to people in a country like America, where we're so about cleanliness and cockroaches are the enemy, and I mean, even crickets are probably scary. I just think we get the heebie-jeebies. We've got a long way to go to accepting that many things can be different than our perception of them in a horror movie, let's say. But the Chinese have always been, by necessity, unbelievable recyclers. I mean, human waste has been used for fertilizer forever. Going back farming.
And to that point, he showed great things. He's done travel. He talked about going to China, and there's a province, which of course it escapes me now, where that's a delicacy. And then he had a whole plate of different insects. And then he showed some, you know, locusts. And he showed locusts where they had gone in and they'd removed parts of the locust. And frankly, he then showed it next to a picture of shrimp. It did not look that different. And he said, you know, and you think about it, and if you can eat a shrimp, once it's been, you know, had its legs removed and everything else, and then a locust, it looks very similar. So if we can accept that as food and see that as a delicacy, then we certainly can make that transition. And he also talked about how, you know, lobster in the East Coast, you know, 100 years ago
was a trash food, right?
And given to people in jail and inmates because it was a sea cockroach. And now it's a delicacy. So things do change, and that may be a good thing, because if they do change, that'll enable people to, you know, hopefully help us all with the burden we're putting on our environment, and realizing that there are billions of people that still don't have adequate amounts of nutrition in their diet, and how do we help them?
Yes, and of course, being at a pet food forum, or the obsessive attention we Americans give, or those of us at least in this little niche of pet food fanatics, if you will, or fascinators, it is sort of obscene that this is our focus when there are so many tens of millions of humans. Forget the quality of their food. They have no food. I get an ethical little quiver about it, but this is our focus and this is what matters to us and right. to so many people who own pets. And it's not a bad thing, but it is important to remember that we are all sharing the planet. So solutions that are come up with for higher quality, but less burdensome foods for pets is obviously part of what we want to think about too. For humans. Sean, but as we wrap up, I just want to know if the issues of, at least in America, pushback against Chinese ingredients, whether it's full ingredients like those, the chicken breast tenders that turned out to have been on some level toxic, unknown the source of it, but they certainly came from China, or the melamine scare that again was, you know, a lot of misunderstanding and some malfeasance. There is a pushback against food ingredients from China in the United States. Even any portion of the ingredients that are in an American-made food and being made in America is now a big selling point. Was that addressed at all there, or is that like our problem in a sense, not theirs?
I think what was interesting is maybe the converse is that they see our products with a higher level of quality too. And the reason I say that is that there was certainly a lot of, as I mentioned, American pet food manufacturers, and what was very key, and what was, I took a photo of this, which was fascinating. Now this is a North American brand, but a Canadian brand, it's a very high end called Origin.
Oh yes, had product we know that. There.
And what was interesting on their bags, I'm familiar with them because they were a main competitor when I was at Natura. And just to point out, you know, when you say Evo, I certainly helped evolve Evo, if you will. I don't know that I get credit for being a true crow creator, but okay. I appreciate the comment.
All right.
but with Origin, it was a main competitor, so I'm very familiar with their packaging. And with their packaging, it was fascinating. They had hologram stickers to prove authenticity, just like you have on a credit card.
Ooh, interesting.
And so even amongst the Chinese market, there certainly is awareness that American or North American brand has cachet, if you will, and a desire and recognition that, you know, that there is the potential for counterfeit.
Right.
And that may signify that it doesn't have quite the same level of quality. So there was at least an undertone of that. I do think that what I was seeing was this was for domestic, as we said, markets. And so they were talking about to their own, you know, local domestic market, not so much about exporting product. But in the few cases where I did talk to people, they would highlight, you know, they had ISO 9000 certification, that they had, you know, inspections and things like that, if they were a supplier that was trying to go elsewhere outside of China to address food quality and safety concerns.
So they're definitely right up there. I mean, if they slipped and made some missteps and got some of our pets or other pets in trouble, it sounds as though they have righted their course and they really get that they have the potential to be major participants in, well, I guess just in China alone, there'd be enough millions of pets in the next, one wants to say decades, but clearly it'll be months or years how quickly things are moving, to have a demand for that quality of food. And how much better in a global sense that it be local food, right? In terms of
I don't think that the Chinese, I think it's a misnomer to think that the Chinese are naive to the concept of quality. I think they understand quality. I think they understand the value of quality. And I think that they are aggressively pursuing it in everything I saw. And I think you can have bad suppliers, as I've always said, in any country. But I think that the Chinese know that they need to be very attentive to that. And if they are, the huge rewards that does for their society and in many cases personally for their economic growth.
I think it's great. I think it's a very upbeat, fascinating, and important message. And I think we all need to, you know, hold hands in a circle and sing kumbaya, because everyone who loves dogs and cats wants everyone else to do well and do it right. And it feels like them bringing you and many other people from around the world to give them insight, to give them advice, to give them support is a great sign that things can always go better, not worse, if you have the right attitude, right?
I think that's always true.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sean. I won't say happy travels because I think you've done a bit enough of traveling at the moment, but it's so wonderful to have you on the road speaking on behalf of the tummies of our dogs and cats. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tracy.